Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Happy Monday. There's so much going on. We have breaking news. The Supreme Court does not let Donald Trump block the grand jury subpoena from New York of his tax record. So that investigation is going to go forward. The Dominion Voting Systems files a $1.3 billion lawsuit against my pillow guy, Mike Lindell. I actually have an anecdote I want to tell a little bit later. Merrick Garland finally gets his Senate hearing as Attorney General. But I think that we have to start by marking this really grim milestone that sometime today, and maybe it's already happened, we will cross the threshold of 500,000 Americans who have died. And I wrote in my newsletter this morning that I think sometimes, you know, maybe we live with it so long, we're just not sufficiently staggered by the magnitude of it. A year ago, it was unimaginable. I remember when we were thinking that, you know, boy, it's not going to get to 50 or 60,000. And remember, a year ago, denial was our official policy. And here's a bit of a flashback from the other guy.
Now, the virus that we're talking about having to do, you know, a lot of people think that goes away in April with the heat.
I think that's a problem that's going to go away. But when you have 15 people and the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero,
it's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
You have to be calm. It'll go away.
It will go away. Just stay calm.
It's going to go away. It's going to go away.
It will go away. You know it. You know it is going away.
It's going to go away. Hopefully at the end of the month. And if not, it hopefully will be soon after that.
I didn't say it. I said it's going away. And it is going away.
You were saying things like, I think it's a problem that's going to go away within a couple of days. Which I'm right about.
It will go away.
It's going to go away. This is going to go away.
It's going to go. It's going to leave. It's going to be gone.
I feel about vaccines like I feel about tests. This is going to go away without a vaccine.
It'll go away at some point. It'll go away.
You know, at some point this stuff goes away, and it's going away. Our numbers are much lower now.
I always say, even without it, it goes away. It's
okay, dying. So I think you get the idea there. And there's Donald Trump didn't say that just once. He said it multiple times. That's a Washington Post audio. We should give them a credit, especially since our next guest is from the Washington Post, James Holman, who is a new opinion columnist for the Washington Post. Good morning, James. How are you?
Good morning, Charlie. Doing great. Good to be with you.
Well, first of all, congratulations on your new position. You and I were talking about the fact that you have, for the last gazillion years, you were the author editor of the Daily 202, a daily newsletter that required you to get up at what, zero dark 30 every day to put out this newsletter?
Yes, I get up at 2 a.m. every day for 5.5 years. And so it's still adjusting to the normal sleep time.
Wow. I told you, you kind of were one of the reasons why you kind of inspired me to start my own newsletter, The Bulwark. And now I'm wondering, what the hell was I thinking? I mean, every single day. I mean, this is, you know, I mean, seriously, people, I mean, the having a take every single day is kind of remarkable. I mean, it's hard. It is difficult. Although I suppose with the flow of news that we've experienced, it's something to do. But anyway, congratulations. But let's talk about this milestone, 500,000. I do feel we're kind of numbed. And, you know, I think here's one way of looking at it. More Americans have died from the COVID-19 than on the battlefields of World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War combined. I mean, that's just stunning.
It's breathtaking. And it is, it's hard to, you know, people just, there's so many ways you can think about it. You know, it's the size of Atlanta, you know, it's like the entire population of Atlanta being wiped out. It's, you know, 1 in 250 Americans, but none of those really capture the rawness, you know, the other side of the bed that's empty, the other side of the dining room table that's not there, the grandpa and grandma that you're never going to see again. And in a lot of cases, it's multiple people in a family. I think it's hard to grasp, and it will be hard to grasp for a long time, just how bad this was. And it didn't have to be this way. As you know, Charlie, obviously we have more deaths by far than any other country in the world. And that's not something we would have expected a year ago. If you would have said 500,000 people are going to die in the U.S., you would have assumed that the numbers would be far worse, proportionally in places like Russia and China. And to some degree, it does seem plausible that China and Russia are lying and covering up some of their death counts, and we're not. But it is just staggering that this has been such a terrible, humiliating episode for the country.
So in terms of just that proportion of death, the number that stuck in my mind is that we have 20% of the world's deaths from the coronavirus, while having only 4% of the population. So it is that out of whack, which is really amazing when you think that we are an advanced industrial nation that before this happened, we would have thought that we Americans were better able to handle this than almost anyone else. And yet here we are. So I think, you know, part of the problem is it's been going on for so long, and a lot of Americans got bored with this thing hundreds of thousands of lives ago, unfortunately. And
yeah,
we have been involved in a lot of denial, wish casting. We've had the tribal politics. So I think that, you know, right now I sense that we're reluctant to be optimistic. There's kind of an outbreak of optimism. There's a lot of reasons to hope. We have these miracle vaccines out there. And yet I think that there's almost a built-in bias, and including among media types, to say, you know, we are almost there. We're almost there. You know what I'm saying? It's like when you get the vaccine, do you get your life back? And there's a reluctance to say you get your life back. But in some ways, that ought to be the message, shouldn't it?
Well, it should. I mean, I think one of the takeaways from this whole ordeal is just kind of the humbling nature of it. You know, I'm a Christian. And so I kind of think in terms of, you know, you know, I'm a God-fearing person. And I think the last year has just shown that man can't conquer nature. You know, obviously there have been these miracle cures, essentially. These vaccines are amazing. The timeline is incredible, but it's amazing how much we still don't know about the vaccines. And it's frankly amazing a year in how much we still don't know about the virus and how exactly it's working and why people with, you know, O positive blood tend to have less severe cases than people with other kinds of blood. And so I think it's kind of been a wake-up call in some ways for how much we don't know and how much, you know, man's hubris put us in jeopardy.
No, that is true. That's it's always important to be humble in the face of nature, and to be reminded of all of that. In terms of the vaccine, though, I do think that there has been a marketing problem because they haven't sold it enough. I think there are too many people who are going, well, you know, 95% is not 100%. That's really, really good. This is an amazing vaccine. And then this whole kind of notion that, well, you know, if you get the vaccine, you're still not going to be able to do any of these things. You had Anthony Fauci on CNN yesterday saying, you know, I'm not going to say that you can actually go and hug your family. So, look, I mean, James, I'm going to be out there. I'm going to get my second dose a week from today. And once I am fully immune, I'm telling you there's going to be hugging. There's going to be going back to normal. Not completely. I'm not going to do raves. I'm not going to do mass spreader events. But, you know, I am going to do things that I used to do pre-pandemic. My wife and I are making lists. We're going to go visit the grandkids. We're going to go to stores. We're going to be doing these things. I may actually get my hair cut. So
I'm excited to go to baseball games. That's my I'm very
fantastic
baseball to be back. And I would love to get the vaccine today. And I agree that there's definitely been a problem in selling it. And it is kind of, to me, it seems crazy that people don't want to take the vaccine when we have the data that we do. And I kind of understand the focus on these vaccine hesitant people, but I want the people who are willing to get the vaccine to get it as soon as possible.
So let's just talk about where we're at right now. You're preparing to be an opinion columnist. We're making this transition into the Biden era. It strikes me this morning as I was making a list of things that I wanted to talk about with you. It's been very difficult to turn the page, though, from Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's because the crazy is still so strong. You have the Republican Party still doubling down on Donald Trump. You have this ongoing purge of anyone who will dare to question the president. He's going to be the former president. He's going to be appearing at CPAC and apparently stake his claim to be the heir apparent in 2024. This is a party that just can't quit him, despite the fact that he was defeated, twice impeached, and was involved in that extraordinary insurrection. And not even that is enough to shake the support.
It really, I anticipated after the election that there would be sort of the Khrushchev speech on Stalin. That moment would come. And I am you know, I guess, you know, when if you look at it in one way, Biden won by 7 million votes. If you look at it in another way, which is, you know, you swing the 20,000 votes in Wisconsin and the, you know, 10 to 15,000 votes in Arizona, you know, the election was actually pretty close. But it's clear now that that's not going to happen. And it does feel like the tension is between sort of Trump light and all in on Trump.
And it's Trumpy versus Trumpier.
Right.
And you see this in one primary election. Tim Miller had a great piece over the weekend where he looks at what's going on in Ohio. And it's like, if you think this party's prepared to move on, forget it, because there are no anti-Trump candidates out there on these primary ballots, with the exception, of course, Lisa Murkowski.
Right. Yeah. And you know, it's going to be, in some ways, that's an opportunity for Democrats, you know, in a place like Ohio. That's a race that Republicans should definitely win, especially with the, you know, an incumbent Democratic president and his first midterm. But if there is a scenario where if it becomes like the 2010 Tea Party primaries, that creates an opening for Democrats to win races that they have really no business winning. And that is why it is incumbent upon Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy on the House side to rein in the Trumpiest elements, because it will make it harder for them to take back the majority in either chamber.
You know, that reference to 2010 is so interesting. The Tea Party primaries, and by the way, that was a whole decade ago. When you think about it, it's like, for people who don't get the references there, this was when the Republicans lost a number of unlosable seats because they nominated crazy people or people who were completely unelectable. You had people like Christine O'Donnell, I am not a witch, Sharon Engel, who was completely nutty. You had people who were saying silly things about rapes, and you lost, you know, arguably three Senate seats right there because of those nominees. And I think that there was kind of a pullback from that, like, we can't go crazy anymore. But that was sort of temporary, wasn't it?
It was sort of like
they kicked the hard stuff for a while, and now they're back.
And it's funny, because in 2014, Republican leaders weighed into a bunch of primaries to make sure that the serious electable people would win. And they really did run a victory lap after the Republicans won control of the Senate in 2014. And they felt like the establishment was back. You know, we can talk about using that term or not. And it really is amazing that then, you know, a year later, Donald Trump comes in and you know, is a bull in a china shop. And now they're back on the juice.
Well, they're back on the juice, and the juice is just spreading. I mean, I know this has now become almost an old story, but the crazification at the local state level of Republican parties dwarfs anything you see at the national level. I mean, yeah, you got your Marjorie Taylor Greens and your Lauren Boberts, et cetera, in Congress. But you go from one state party to another, and it's like, what is going on out there? I mean, it is like something in the water. And one story after another, I was reading Jim Swift's newsletter from Friday night about the lieutenant governor in North Carolina, Republican. I mean, this guy is out there with some of the most bizarre anti-Semitic comments you can imagine. The Republican leading candidate for governor, I mean, is just woof. Arizona, Oregon, I mean, wherever you look, these state level parties have really, it's almost like it's not just that they're Trumpy. It's like they've embraced something. What's the next step beyond Trumpy?
Right. And it's obviously Trump created a permission structure for people to be crazy. And that, it's hard to see how that gets unwound except with electoral defeat. I mean, I do think if in 2022 Republicans fail to win back the House or the Senate, both of which in normal historic times should be pretty easy, I do think that might then lead to some reckoning going into the 2024 primaries. But frankly, anything could happen. But you could see Trump being the nominee again in 2024. But that's not out of the question at all. And you do have the, you mentioned Sharon Engel in the context of 2010. She's one of the people who's, you know, is as nutty as ever and doing a lot of nutty stuff in the Nevada GOP.
Oh, yeah. And you get Kelly Ward is kind of a, you know, Sharon Engel 2.0. So let me tell you just a Wisconsin story that is just like blowing my mind here. And it seems particularly timely, especially since Dominion, the voting machine company, has just filed this lawsuit against MyPillow guy for that video, which is I mean, to say that that video is wacky and bizarre is understating the case. So in Wisconsin, the beating heart of the Republican Party up until recently, maybe he still is crucial Waukesha County.
Right.
In the Milwaukee suburbs. I mean, that's been the story. I think people know about Waukesha County. I mean, it's been this massive vote engine for Republicans. And generally, if you're running statewide, you want to get Waukesha County Republicans on your side in a primary. They have become increasingly, and I want to say, and I'm kind of working on this, the, you know, post-Trumpy, it's sort of like they've been hooked on the crack and now they've moved on to fentanyl or something. fentanyl. I mean, it's just something I just... So here's the story from Jim Wigderson of Wright, Wisconsin, over the weekend. The Waukesha County Republican Party, once the proud engine that drove the state Republican Party, pandered again to its wacko wing on Friday. The party officially sponsored a showing of the MyPillow guy's movie, Absolute Proof. This is his version of what happened, you know, when Trump lost the election. You know, the movie, you know, talks about the algorithmic error, but they actually had an official event. The Republican Party of Waukesha had a movie night. They had 80 people that show up to watch My Pillow Guy's movie. And apparently the people walked down saying, yes, absolutely, some terrible things were happening. And this is a group of people that, at least in my imagination, I thought were rational human beings 5 minutes ago. Not 5 minutes ago, mm-hmm. but five years ago.
5 years ago.
And so... You know, we keep focusing on Trump or not Trump, but what happens when an entire political party loses its freaking mind?
Well, we need a strong two-party system, and it is. I mean, the party is in the thralls of Trumpism, and it is an addiction, and it certainly is not conservatism. You know, the country is going to be in a precarious place. The republic will be in a precarious place until. The party can break that fever, and, you know, leaders of goodwill. That's why, you know, over the weekend, Steve Scalise saying, you know, refusing to acknowledge that Joe Biden is the rightful winner of the election. When leaders are sowing that kind of doubt, it is so dangerous, because the majority of Republicans in polls, including polls that were released over the weekend, continue to believe that Biden is not a legitimate president. And that is bad, because it's going to make it really hard to do anything.
Well, yeah, since you mentioned Steve Scalise, this is Steve Scalise, who is on ABC with Jonathan Carl, who's trying to get him to answer basic questions about Donald Trump's responsibility for the insurrection, which he refuses to do, and dances around the questions of the legitimacy of the election. This is Steve Scalise from yesterday morning.
But wait a minute. I mean, he hasn't taken responsibility. You heard Kevin McCarthy say, I mean, do you agree with what Kevin McCarthy said there, that the president must take responsibility, that the facts demand that he take responsibility for what happened on January 6th?
Well, first of all, I wrote a Wall Street Journal editorial about where I think the responsibility lays for January 6th, and surely there's a lot of blame to go around, but at the end of the day, the people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, it was a disgrace. And they need to be held accountable. And in fact, over 180 have already been arrested. And I know the FBI is working to root out every person who broke into the Capitol, who attacked police.
Obvious. I'm asking about Donald Trump's role in this. You heard, again, Kevin McCarthy. Do you agree with what he said, that he bears responsibility for what happened? Yeah.
Well, again, you can go back and look at the impeachment trial, the second impeachment trial. It seems like all they've done since the day he walked into office was try to impeach him. But again, when you look at that trial, they ran a clip of pretty much every United States senator who voted to impeach President Trump, who talked about things like go and fight like hell and other things like that.
So you're saying he doesn't bear responsibility.
When
you're saying
look
he
at
doesn't.
President, when you look, President Trump has denounced what happened. And I think everybody should have been unequivocal in their denouncing of what happened. Not only on January 6th, but during the summer when they were burning down cities, shooting cops, beating people in the streets. You saw the left denouncing January 6th as we did. They didn't denounce what happened during the summer. So let's be across the board and say anybody who resorts to violence to settle political disputes, there's no place for that in America. And it should be disputed unequivocally.
Well, that's Olympic level whataboutism, isn't it, James?
It really is. And you know, the House Republican Conference is much Trumpier than the Senate Republican conference. And that is why you have to think about incentives. And, you know, Steve Scalise wants to be speaker someday. And he is playing to where the conference is. That's not an outlier. You know, that's not a gaffe. That's Scalise, a savvy politician, making a calculation that that's the position he has to stake out to maintain his role as number two.
Well, that's right. These are the litmus tests, right? The litmus test is you have to drop the insurrection into the memory hole, and you have to continue to refuse to acknowledge the legitimacy of the election.
And this is the reason we keep talking about Donald Trump, because we have to. You know, we can't put this in the memory hole. It is this defining moment. Obviously, the 75 days between the election and the inauguration posed this significant stress test for the democracy. And I think one of the things that the second impeachment trial did show was how much kind of closer we came to real peril than we even realized at the time. And so it's hard, because I would love to not talk about Donald Trump anymore. But the Republicans, the party can't move on. And until there's a recognition that Biden did win the election and that Trump did play a role in inciting the insurrection, the country's not going to be able to heal.
Well, also, you know, we should mention, you know, Steve Scalise has a particular perspective on this, because he was shot and very badly wounded early in the Trump presidency by somebody from the left who was perhaps who was deranged by over the top political rhetoric. So you would think that he would deal with this with a special sensitivity. I mean, it's one thing for somebody else to go through with a boilerplate whataboutism, but you would think that Steve Scalise would be in a unique position to say, folks, we have to dial this down. We have to step back from this. This cannot continue. This is dangerous. This is deadly. It's deadly when it comes from, you know, a blogger. It's deadly when it comes from a president of the United States. But, you know, the hackification of the party is truly remarkable. Okay, so where do we go with this, though? Because I know that there's the temptation to move on, but it wasn't that long ago. I mean, this is part of the time warp we live in. Joe Biden was inaugurated just a month ago. The attack on the Capitol was less than 2 months ago. We're getting more and more information from the criminal investigations suggesting conspiracies involving some of these militia groups, the involvement of Roger Stone, who was financing all of this. Where do you see this going?
Well, I'm fascinated to watch these trials play out, and especially any connection to Alex Jones and Roger Stone.
Yeah.
And it was with that McConnell speech, the Mitch McConnell speech after he voted to acquit, you know, in which he said Donald Trump's not off the hook yet. And he put the emphasis on yet and emphasized that he could face criminal or civil penalties. It will be fascinating to see what plays out in Fulton County and Georgia, where they're continuing to investigate Trump pushing the Republican Secretary of State to find the votes that he needed. And I do think things will emerge at trial that highlight the role that some of the groups tied closely to Trump played in everything that happened on January 6th. You know, the original permit didn't call for going to the Capitol, for a march to the Capitol. There's a lot of things that I think could end up getting sort of fleshed out in litigation. And I do think you will see a lot of these defendants using sort of the Trump defense, and it will be fascinating to see how that plays out.
So I think it's kind of interesting this morning watching Merrick Garland's confirmation hearing. Realize that Merrick Garland has been, you know, such a the name has been, you know, to be, you know, has been a name to conjure with for years and years and years. And this is the first time I've ever heard him speak.
Right.
So, but his remarks, and I didn't hear them live, the pre-written remarks would suggest that he's really laying down a marker about an independent Justice Department, but also how aggressive he is going to be in investigating these white supremacist, white nationalist militia groups. What a priority that's going to be. It's interesting that on day one, he's signaling that the Justice Department is going to war with many of these seditious organizations.
Yeah, and I think he has a mandate to do that. And I do think he will be an independent attorney general. And I do take the White House at their word that they're not going to get involved in a lot of these decisions that, that Trump did. And I think that, you know, that he will have, it's going to be ironic to watch a bunch of the senators vote to confirm him as AG who supported the blockade. Chuck Grassley made a joke, actually, that was funny, that said, this is the first time you've appeared before the committee since you were confirmed as a judge, and I had something to do with that. I think there is going to be a whole of government response. I don't think it'll just be DOJ. I think that there will... We'll be seeing a lot from DHS as well on cracking down on domestic violent extremism.
Okay, so we don't know what a big deal, how big a deal it's going to be. But again, as I mentioned at the top of the show, the Supreme Court has again rejected Trump's bid to shield his tax returns and other financial records from the Manhattan prosecution, prosecutors and their grand jury. So that investigation's going forward. We might as well just sort of leave that aside because that's certainly that is certainly out there. So just switching the focus just a little bit. I'm always interested in the question of how do people survive scandals, and what is our attention span? So the context here is Ted Cruz. Does Ted Cruz come back from the Cancun thing?
Yes, he does. And he will bluster through it. And, you know, it was actually striking, not to criticize the media, but the way that, you know, I saw the opening montage on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday, and they were showing the pictures of Ted Cruz putting water in people's trunks. And, you know, I do think that it, in this day and age, especially if you have no shame, you really can move through. I mean, you look at someone like Donald Trump, and they used to call Ronald Reagan the Teflon president, but that Donald Trump gave that a whole new meaning. I don't know if there's a material that's more Teflon-y than Teflon.
Yeah, but Cruz is not Teflon. Cruz is the guy that everybody likes to hate, right? So you hated him before, and then it was really fun hating him again next week.
Yeah, and there's something to that. You know, the Lindsey Graham quote that if Ted Cruz was killed and the trial was in the Senate, the murderer would be acquitted. And Ted Cruz, I do think Ted Cruz has unique baggage that's going to be very hard for him to, I think it'll be very hard for him to be the Republican nominee in 2024. And I think I don't think he has a real base, but he, as if he's not up for reelection until November 2024. And I assume he said publicly that he wants to run again for president. He may not end up doing that, but he will continue to be a potent force, and he will, he'll be, because partly he's willing to engage when a lot of Republicans are quiet and just trying to keep their heads down. He's happy to be that warrior. I mean, it was wild to watch him sitting in the in the room with Trump's lawyers during the trial, and you could see him at a laptop pounding out stuff for them to say during recess breaks when the door was open. The fact that Cruz batted cleanup for Trump after everything that Trump said and did about him and his family and everything else says a lot about his character. So I think that this may be one of those things that does stick with Cruz, but Cruz is going to continue to be a pretty significant figure on the right, especially, but in our national politics for a very long time.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably true, although he might want to keep his head down and not talk about his daughters for a little while. So it looks like the Biden administration is going to suffer its first big defeat with the nomination of Neera Tanden to be the director of the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget. She'd always been the most controversially of the opponents. I mean, I personally like her, but she had a Twitter account, and like a lot of people with Twitter accounts, managed to flame a lot of people, piss off a lot of people. So she lost Joe Manchin's vote the other day, this morning, Susan Collins, and I guess in the last few minutes, Mitt Romney came out against her. So that would certainly suggest that that nomination is in, if it's not going down, it's in really serious trouble.
Yeah, and it's very hard to see where they would get the 50th vote. Now with those people, you know, someone like Rob Portman, who was the OMB director, is the kind of person who you might in an ordinary time expect, you know, he's retiring. He had the job, but he's been one of the kind of, he's been whipping votes against her in the Republican conference, and it sort of has worked. And there is some pressure from the left. You know, Neera's not a Bernie person, but yeah, kind of the she ran a liberal think tank, that there could be a recess appointment, you know, potentially after the COVID relief bill passes. There's some talk that Biden could use a recess appointment to put her in. But it's very hard to see her getting confirmed. It's hard to see which Republican would do that.
It is kind of, and I'm sorry to use the word ironic since irony was killed a long time ago, that it appears that her mean tweets are what is going to sink her. When some of these same senators voted for, say, Rick Grenell,
right,
put up with Donald Trump, and if mean tweets was a disqualification, that a lot of Republicans have a lot of explaining to do, that's number one. Number two, the OMB position is a little bit different than other cabinet positions because it's really part of the executive office, isn't it? I mean, if there's any position where you would normally think the senators would say, hey, we may not like this person, but we should defer to the, you know, the president should have his own people. This is not an independent agency. It's really almost like a quasi member of the staff.
It
or
is.
Would you have it? Yeah.
So, yeah. No, it's part of the, I mean, they're literally, her office is in the White House complex. It's,
yeah.
It is. Historically, senators in both parties have shown more deference the closer you are to the president, in kind of a staff job. You know, you would be more, you know, skeptical of a secretary of state or, you know, someone who was sort of, or a secretary of defense, right, or an attorney general. And I think that is part of what's changing. To your point about mean tweets, couldn't agree more. That, you know, it is funny in this day of social media, there's always been kind of conversations about, well, when everyone has Facebook accounts, does that mean that, like, it won't be scandalous anymore when this kind of stuff comes up in confirmation hearings? And I think that this shows that it will be, you know, and that in this kind of, like, the politics of personal destruction will continue in the digital age, if not get worse.
Well, also that people don't have any problem saying, yeah, I don't pay any attention to Donald Trump's tweets. Oh, don't look at his tweets. Look at what he does. And to have those same people turn around and say, no, we're going to judge you based on your tweets. So that's not going to. Okay, so I want to just go back because I something else I've been thinking about over the weekend, and this goes back to our original topic about the coronavirus and looking back on the last year. One of the really remarkable things that has happened in the last, I don't know, 2-3 weeks has been the fall from grace of Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, who for months and months and months was this sort of Democratic superstar. He was the anti-Trump, and all the people who were disgusted by Trump's horrible handling of the coronavirus were embracing Andrew Trump, I mean, Andrew Cuomo, and they were you know, the cable stations ran his press conferences live. He wrote a book about what a great job he did. And now we're finding out that the guy's handling of it is, and I use this word advisedly, is scandalous. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way they covered up, you know, a huge number of deaths at nursing homes, the way that he fudged the numbers, the way that he ignored the scientists, the way that he bullied others. And it does strike me, though, that this is you look back on and, you know, think about how we didn't see that, or, you know, how he was lionized at a time when he was actually screwing things up royally. Or am I overstating it?
No, you're not overstating it at all. I've always been baffled by the Cuomo treatment, especially last spring. You know, this is a guy whose whole tenure as governor has been marred by scandal, frankly. You know, pre-Bararo, when he was the Southern District of New York U.S. attorney, was investigating the whole Moreland Commission. You know, Cuomo's has a long history of behaving in ethically dubious ways. And so, you know, I've always thought he was the most overrated governor. I think part of it, Charlie, is kind of live by the New York media market, die by the New York media market.
Right.
And I think some of it is the same phenomenon, frankly, that we saw with Chris Christie, where Chris Christie for years was, you know, way more elevated than he should have been. New Jersey is not even that significant or important a state. But it's because he was right there, and a lot of the big, especially TV channels, are headquartered in New York. And so, you know, Christie got tons of plaudits, and then we saw with the Bridgegate stuff that that's who he actually is. Similarly, we're now seeing with the nursing home scandal and other scandals, you know, that Cuomo has always been a bully and is not actually particularly competent, and has long been overrated. So I think that there is this tendency of the kind of the television media, especially, to elevate people from the New York media market who are not actually that good.
Well, it's also just a reminder of the danger of a hyperpartisan lens, because I think that there was, and I say this is obvious, somebody was never Trump, still am never Trump, but the willingness to embrace anyone who was not Trump or anti-Trump and to overlook their flaws. I mean, you think about the media and Michael Avenatti.
Yeah.
You think, which is not, of course, the same thing as being the governor of New York.
No, but it was embarrassing the way that he got, Avenatti got elevated.
Right. It is embarrassing. I mean, Omarosa. I mean, you can make a long list of this sort of thing. And
Michael Cohen.
Well, yes, exactly. And that suddenly, and there were people who figured that they could just, you know, wash themselves in the blood of anti-Trumpism and really were not that much different than Donald Trump. But you know, this is part of the lens that, you know, if you were Trump, you got the full legitimate scrutiny. And when I say, I mean, legitimate scrutiny, I don't think he was treated unfairly. I think he got exactly, you know, the kind of attention and the kind of accountability that he should have had from the media and from critics. But that wasn't always the case. And I think that that's part of the problem of our side, your side. I mean, I think, for example, that Ron DeSantis is a thug. And I think that, you know, he needs to be dragged as well. But, you know, in what world is he the worst guy and Andrew Cuomo is a hero?
Right.
And I'm not defending DeSantis. I'm just saying, if you have a standard, apply it to everybody.
I agree, the whataboutism, you know, I agree. You can't praise DeSantis and criticize Cuomo and vice versa.
Right.
And and some of it also, frankly, is like, I mean, the book, Cuomo writing the book was laughably ridiculous at the time, you know, as the pandemic is still going on. And some of it is that, you know, some leaders will look better with time. You know, some of the leaders who pushed to reopen schools and were dragged for it, frankly, have been validated. So it will be interesting, you know, when the pandemic is sort of over, to your point too about Cruz going to Cancun, like what will people remember about their various governors and the way they responded to COVID? You know, Kristi Noem obviously refused to put in place a statewide mask mandate. You know, is that going to hurt her at all in 2024 when she tries to run for the nomination or in a general election?
You know, this raises a larger question, and maybe this is going to be too big a leap here. But I was thinking about it. I was over the weekend when I was thinking about the Rush Limbaugh and about CPAC and a variety of other things. The way the right has turned its shamelessness into a superpower, and the way it has really been wildly successful in creating this alternative media structure, but how ultimately self-defeating it is because they talk to themselves all the time.
Yeah, it's an echo chamber on the left too. But yes, I think the right is more echo chambery than ever, in the sense that, you know, people, obviously not people listening to I think it's a huge problem that you're only getting validation of what you already think, and you're exposing yourself never to opinions that challenge what you think, and that creates the circular, you know, where then it doesn't become a big leap to go to watch the Mike Lindell movie at the Waukesha Republican Party, you know, event, because you're just, it's sort of normalized because you're listening to six different media sources, but all six of them are telling you the exact same thing and uncritically so.
Well, and this is also something that you see in the discourse, that there's no longer an attempt to persuade, you know, here's my argument and I want you to change your mind to join me. Now it is just simply, you know, reiterating the points, pounding the points, you know, the mad libs of various memes and narratives. And so I do think that many people on the right have just sort of given up on persuasion. And clearly, yeah, people like Limbaugh had near the end, and a lot of his imitators do as well.
Right.
I mean, does Ben Shapiro aim to convert people, or does he just, you know, want to have liberal tears?
You know, that I think the latter, but you know, I remember listening to Limbaugh in the 90s, and he would do long segments like making the case for deregulation.
I remember this, about, yeah,
welfare reform, obviously Wisconsin, mm-hmm, center, front center there, Tommy Thompson. But the that you know, whenever I would turn on Rush toward the end, there was never any of that. You know, that and I do think a lot of the imitators, you know, I think it is about, it's about trying to trigger people for the sense of triggering them, not for the sense of persuading them. And frankly, you know, antagonizing people isn't a good way to win converts, usually ever.
Well, that's right. And that's, you know, that's contributed to the level of the debate. Just, I mean, we talk about how intensely divided we are, but also the way that debate has been dumbed down. So, Merrick, while you and I are speaking here, Merrick Garland is saying the Capitol attack investigation will be his first priority, which I think is very, very encouraging, because one of my concerns is that Joe Biden will take the rhetoric of unifying and moving on so seriously that we don't have that moment of reckoning that we so desperately need for what happened on January 6th and the other things that Trump might have done on the way out the door.
I agree with that. And I think, you know, there was some tension. We had a story in the Post a couple of weeks ago about a divide among prosecutors, because there is, you know, some sense of, well, do you really go after everyone, or do you just go after the people who were involved in the conspiracy? And there clearly is some divide within, you know, prosecutors may be reluctant to bring cases that, prosecutors never like to bring cases that maybe aren't slam dunks. But I think it is important for the country to move forward, for there to be accountability, and to get to the bottom of what role Roger Stone and Alex Jones and these different groups played, and who knew what and when. So it is heartening to hear Garland say that, because Biden's tendency is to back down. You know, Biden is the kind of leader who, you know, in 1974 would have pardoned Richard Nixon, frankly.
You think so? Really?
I do. I think, you know, I think he is kind of an old school variety. And I don't like his inclination, his tendency is to not fight when faced with that choice, because he wants to be liked. And he does. I do think like the unity rhetoric is partly a shtick. You know, it's partly, mm-hmm, kind of that it was the right message for the moment to win in 2020 post Trump. But I do think he has this kind of this inclination to be this deal maker and to bring people together. And I think there's definitely a risk for him that, you know, means that, you know, that he kind of wastes time and doesn't focus on the right things in his agenda because he believes he's going to be able to win widespread support for something that ultimately he's not going to be able to. But we'll see. You know, he has a half century record that would suggest that he doesn't have kind of a killer instinct in a political sense.
And yet they are pushing the $1.9 trillion stimulus package through, apparently through reconciliation. So he's not slowing up waiting for Susan Collins to come on board. They're not negotiating with Republicans saying, you know, we'll hold until we have the bipartisan majority.
And I think that's a direct result of feeling burned still from 2009, Biden was the one who was in the White House, in the Obama White House, pushing them to wait to give Chuck Grassley time to come around on the ACA. You know, and there's this feeling, not among Biden as much as like a lot of his aides and longtime, you know, advisors who say like, don't get burned another time. And so that, I do think that's directly why they were willing to move forward so fast and skip over a lot of that process.
Okay, we're almost done here, but since you mentioned 1974 and the Nixon pardon, I've actually been engaging in my own bit of historical revisionism, because when I was a kid, I remember when they made a TV series out of John F. Kennedy's Profiles in Courage.
I actually
that's what a geek I was as a kid. And I remember the episode they had about the one senator who cast the vote against the removal, the conviction of Andrew Johnson. And how he was staring, I think he was from Kansas, and he was staring into his open political grave, and how courageous he was to keep Andrew Johnson in office. And of course, that was the belief that this was a good thing that we did not remove Andrew Johnson. Now I look back on that and say, Andrew Johnson was one of the worst human beings on earth. perhaps it would have been a good thing to remove him, because then impeachment might have meant something. And then fast forward to 1974, I guess I was among those who thought that the pardon of Richard Nixon was a good thing because it enabled the country to heal and not have to go through that nightmare. But now you look back on those two events and you realize we've created this kind of this tradition or this culture of not holding ex-presidents accountable for their behavior. And I wonder whether or not these were mistakes, that I look back at the pardon of Richard Nixon, I think, less favorably now than I did back then.
Yeah, I mean, I think you reasonable people can disagree on the Nixon pardon. I think that there is a case to be made that, you know, it would have been a nightmare for that to play out. The former president to be, you know, we don't want to be a country where former presidents routinely end up behind bars. You know, that's not
routinely, but occasionally, once in a while.
It is funny because I went back and reread that chapter in JFK's Profiles in Courage from during the first impeachment trial, and it really doesn't hold up well. And it is funny that, you know, that gave sort of a bad, the Johnson impeachment gave this bad name to impeachment, which is why we went 100 years without having one, more than 100 years without having a process. Obviously Nixon wasn't actually impeached, but the articles were passed through the committee, and so the one of the things I do wonder, to your point, is like, how is this going to become the new norm? Obviously we don't want a lot of political impeachments, but I would argue, and I know you would agree, that January 6th, you know, that's not a political impeachment. But I do wonder if that's going to become sort of the norm when any party has a majority in both chambers, you're going to see the president get impeached. You know, and it is, you think back to like Iran-Contra in, you know, that you can imagine scenarios where that's going to become
easily,
you know, the norm. And I'm not sure that's actually a good thing.
Yeah. But then we need to have some sort of a mechanism that holds presidents accountable in some way. And because the alternative is a president who is literally above the law. And that's scary. And I think we push the envelope on that with this president.
I mean, one of the things I hope that comes out of the Biden era is more of a rebalancing of executive and legislative power. More broadly, this long predates Trump. Trump, I think, hypercharged this trend, but the legislative is supposed to be a co-equal branch with the executive. And right now it's more of a moot point because the same party controls the executive and the legislative. But I do think for the Republic's sake, there needs to be the legislative branch needs to assert itself more than it did the last 4 years.
Yeah, I could not agree more. James Holman, thank you for coming back on the podcast. We really appreciate it. James Holman, a new opinion columnist for the Washington Post, the longtime editor of the Daily 202, which, as I had told you, was always my daily must read every single day. You did a fantastic job. Now that I actually do a daily newsletter, I'm more impressed with what you did than ever before. The fact that you came up with that, it was so substantive. There was so much in that. And every once in a while, I tried to, you know, print it out, but it was so long, I'd run out of paper. But you did that every single day. And so I know that you pass it off to good hands, but I am going to miss you in the Daily 202, but look forward to your columns.
Thank you so much, Charlie, and really enjoyed our conversation. Fun to be with you.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.